Okay, good evening.
Good evening.
Welcome to the Passover edition of Talmud. So, long delayed. And last time, if you'll remember, we talked about when Christians stop being Jews. And tonight, we're not going to talk about that, but we are going to talk about one of the things we did last time, which were meaning. So before I get to that, let me first acknowledge that much of what I've done tonight comes from the work of a scholar named Michal Bar Asher Siegel, which is a mouthful. At any rate, to very quickly recap what we talked about last time, the question was about heretics in Jewish life. And there were really two kinds of heretics. There were heretics in thought and heretics in deeds. Heretics in thought were called minim, where min is the singular, and heretics in deeds were apikoros, or mishumid, or mumars. They had many names. So we're not talking about them at all tonight. So we're going to concentrate on min. The modern Hebrew word min means type or kind. God creates minim in the creation story. No one knows the etymology of the word mean, so there are some thoughts that it is a contraction of the Hebrew word ma'amin, which means believer, and that's, if you hear in there, ma'amin is the word amen, which really means I believe, or so be it.
Isn't mean also spices?
Mean are, I think they are also spices.
That's bisamin.
Bisamin.
Thank you. Thank you.
There's also, this is even cuter, min is an acronym for the Hebrew words ma'amine Yeshua hanotzri, those who believe in Jesus the Nazarite. But it sounds a little far-fetched. Mm-hmm. So, a min is someone that doesn't agree, this is not going to be so technical, so don't worry about that. A min is someone who doesn't believe in the standards of the day, whatever it is. And it has changed over time. So in the Tannaitic period, the people who put together the Mishnah, 0 to 200, you had minim were Sadducees and Pharisees. They were the definition. The Pharisees went on to win. In the Amoraic period, they were people who believed in heretical things, like the Jewish Christians, people who believed in more than one God, like the Persian Zoroastrians. And after that period, kind of when the Talmud came to an end, a min really meant an outsider, a complete outsider, a non-Jew, a pagan, a Christian. So the word min appears 7 times in the Mishnah, 16 times in the Tosefta, and it never occurs in the Hebrew Bible. And really, all these people were opponents of the rabbis, so they challenged the rabbis. And again, mean went from meaning just an innocuous word, kind or type, to heretic, just like the word goy, right? In the Bible, goy means country, but today to us, goy means non-Jew. It's an evolution of the word. Okay. So now we're going to talk about minim in the Talmud. And there's a kind of a set type. So just like in America we have Westerns as a kind of set type, there is a type of story you find all through the Talmud where there are minim who are debating the rabbis. And naturally the rabbis win. But these stories come about in the Babylonian Talmud, mostly, interestingly, which is influenced by Persia, not in the Palestinian rabbis who were writing the Jerusalem Talmud. So, with all that being said as an introduction, we're going to look at a story now that's one of those, and I'm going to challenge you. Tonight is like a psychological puzzle, so you can think about why things are the way they are. So, we're going to read the story, and then we're going to go back and unpack it and take a look at what's going on, figure that out. So, this comes from the tractate Eruvin. Eruvin's, most people know, Eruv is about the thing that delineates the boundary. Eruv really means mixture. And so a lot of it is about mixture of holy and not holy, or really Shabbat and non-Shabbat things. That's why an Eruv is an area on Shabbat you can walk in, carry in. Outside the Eruv, you can't. Okay, now we start the story. Our rabbis taught, if boughs of thorn bushes or bundles of wood were prepared to serve as a stopgap for a breach in a courtyard, whenever they are fastened and suspended, it is permitted to close with them on the Sabbath, and much more so on a festival day, on a Yom Tov. Okay, so what this story is about is you have a set of bushes with a gap in it. And the question is, can you take a plant or a bush or a thorn bush and block up that gap on Shabbat? Is that a legal thing to do? And that's what the rabbis are debating here. they give you their answer here that it is permitted. I was going to say, I don't even know what the resolution is. Okay, so the thorn bush is the theme here, and that's what kicks off the actual story, which is the next two paragraphs. So I'm going to read through it first, and then we're going to go back and understand it. So a certain heretic, and the Talmud says Amin, once said to Rabbi Joshua ben Chananya, "Man of thorns, for it says about you, the best of them is as a briar." He said to him, "Fool, go down to the end of the verse. The most upright is worse than a thorn hedge." What is the meaning of "the best of them is as a briar"? It means that just as the thorns protect a breach, so the best among us protect us. Alternatively, the best of them is as a briar, and the Hebrew word is chedek, which I'll tell you right now is a difficult word and no one really knows what it means, which is always a place then where the rabbis are going to start riffing on it, means that they grind, and now this is a related Hebrew word, mechadekin, the nations of the world into Gehenna, as it is stated. "Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make your horn iron, I will make your hoofs brass, and you shall beat in pieces many peoples, and you shall devote their gain to God, and their substance to the God of the whole earth." Okay, confusing, right?
Yeah.
This is a weird story. So let's go back and look at it slowly. First, before we do that, we will look at, if you go down to where it says Micah 7:4, MT, right? Everyone see that? And there is Tovim Kechedek. The best of them is like a chedek. And you can see the English translation, which is what you saw in the text above. But here I give you the whole text, which is equally confusing. The best of them is as a briar. The most upright is worse than a thorn hedge. That's the part that we have. The day of your watchman, even your visitation, has come. Now shall be their perplexity. Okay, so you see that. So let's go back now to the second paragraph. So, what is this? The mean is coming to the rabbi and basically engaging in a battle of wits over the meaning of the Torah. Oh, it's not the Torah, the Bible, the Tanakh. Again, this is a way to challenge the rabbis, to make the rabbis look foolish. So, and this is the famous Joshua ben Chananya, who figures in many of these stories. So, he calls him Man of Thorns. Why? This is a pejorative name. This is an insult. Because the text says the best of them is as a briar. So what is he saying? He's saying you, Rabbi Joshua, are the best person among the Jews. And yet you are like a lowly thorn bush. Meaning all the rest of the Jews are so much worse than you. So it's not a compliment, right? It's an insult. Everyone get that? This, I spent a lot of time looking at this, and it's not obvious. Okay, so what is... This is a derogatory expression pretending to be praise. Like, kind of like saying, you know, wow, you're the best liar I know. It's in that vein. So it's a put down. But of course, he's Rabbi Joshua ben Chananya, so he has a retort. First of all, he calls him a fool, which is not that common in the Talmud.
How do you know who's speaking to who?
You never do. It's
right.
Like the Torah.
So we're guessing that this is Joshua talking.
Well, he's replying to him.
No, I agree. That makes the sense. I just need to make that point.
Could you have read it that way? Yes. You'd have a hard time explaining to me what it means.
I agree. I just felt the need to make that point. Because I love when they do that.
Sometimes, by the way, when I get the English, they interpolate who it is. Like, it'll say, fool, parentheses, the heretic. And I take those out because I want them to be ambiguous, because I want people like you to say, maybe it means this instead. Okay, so he calls him a fool, and he says, go to the end of the verse. And the end of the verse says, the most upright is worse than a thorn hedge. So, what is he saying to him? He's turning the negative into a positive. He's saying the best aspect of Israel's leadership, or the best among them, is like a thorn. But now it's in a positive sense. He's a thorn. He's a fighter. He's against the enemy. So, again, in English you might say, you know, you're a pain in the neck, and you might say, well, that's good because I'm fighting evil. So I want to be a pain in the neck to evil. So that's how he retorts. And, of course, the real retort is here that he's using the same verse that the heretic quotes in his face back into the heretic's face. So that's part one. And then he goes on to say, the Talmud goes on to say, let's give you another explanation. What is the meaning of the best of them is as a briar? In other words, it's unclear. Tovim kechedek, what does that mean? It means just as the thorns protect a breach in the gap, so the best among us are the breach in the gap. They protect us. So all of that has come to say, that's answer number one. It's kind of straightforward when you take it apart. He's taking the insult, reversing it, throwing it back. Everyone good with that? Okay. Now you get alternatively, which is always an interesting thing, because whenever you get more than one explanation, it means nobody's happy with either explanation. So they give you another explanation of what is the best of them is as a thorn or a briar. And he says it means they grind the nations of the world into Gehenna.
How does a briar grind something?
It doesn't. So
no, the best
the
of them
word,
is doing the briar.
No.
Is doing the grinding.
No.
The word briar is related, like a sherish, the root for the word grind.
Exactly.
Oh.
That's why I put them out here, mechadekin. So.
Okay.
That's why he's playing on the word. And by the way, the briar itself is not a clear explanation for what this word is, as you will see shortly. And then he goes and he gives you this quote from Micah, which is the one that immediately follows this paragraph. It's from a different place in Micah. And again, there you're getting the whole quote, not just the piece they're using. Actually, you are getting the whole quote in both places, but they don't quite translate them the same. But here you can see the word v'chadikot at the end of the Hebrew, and that's where he's using for the word is to crush or grind. Okay, so what's he responding to the heretic here? He's saying, this quote means your people, or the rest of the world, let's say, are going to be crushed by the Jews and thrown into hell. Right? That's what that means. They grind the nations of the world into Gehenna. So he's the second answer of the Talmud to this challenge is taking it to another level by bringing in Gehenna and this existential warfare between Jews and Gentiles. And I hope your reaction is, huh? Where did that come from? Because that's going to be the mystery. Why did he come up with that, right? The first answer we can get. They're interpreting Bible verses, dueling verses. But the second answer is just out of nowhere.
But the second answer is analyzing the insult. It's not analyzing the retort.
Yes, that's right. But it's turning it back into a retort.
Right, but it's not having Joshua turn it back into a retort. The Talmud itself is turning it back.
Yes, yes, that is true. And I don't know if we can attribute it to Joshua or not. And it's certainly not, there's no he and him in this
right,
one.
Right, it doesn't.
So I don't know about that. Okay, so this is the puzzle I want you to keep in your head for the moment while we go down another path, which I think is going to be very interesting and a lot of fun. So I'm going to digress for a moment and talk about the Septuagint. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Torah that was made in the 3rd century BCE. And a lot of you are probably familiar with the legend that I think it was King Ptolemy of Egypt got together 72 rabbis, 6 rabbis from each tribe, put each of them in a separate room on an island off of Egypt, and told them to translate the Torah. And when they were all done and they compared them, every single manuscript of the Torah was the same. So that work is called the Septuagint, which means 70, 70, 72. They're really the same kind of thing. Scholarly, they call it the LXX, which is the Roman numerals for 70. And what's important was this was the only Greek version of the Bible in existence for hundreds of years. It was the only Bible that non-Jewish Christians could read. Because they couldn't read Hebrew, they couldn't read Aramaic, of which there were several translations. They could read Greek. So, this is the text that the Christians would have looked at. And now you'll see the translation from the LXX, which is second to the bottom, of the best of them is as a briar, comes out in Greek as like a moth larva devouring and crawling upon a weaver's rod. In the day of your keeping, watch. Woe, woe, your punishment has come, now shall be their lamentations. Okay, so once again, where does this come from? Okay, first of all, Christians loved this passage to use about themselves. And they understood it to mean the church was getting corrupt, right? Christians always worried about that throughout the years. That's how we got Protestantism and so on. But that was their verse. Now, they translated the Greek word chedek, briar, into moth. Where'd they get that? Well, it turns out that there are many verses in the Bible, our Bible, about moths and insects that do a lot of devouring of things. So, and usually, in Jewish terms, the moths refer to things that eat away at the enemies of Israel. So, what you're going to see now here is a whole string of Bible verses that all kind of leapfrog on one another and come out to a different place. And I promise you we'll come back and get it. So, from this verse, we now go back to a verse of Isaiah. Behold, the Lord God will help me. Who is he that shall condemn me? Behold, they shall wax old as a garment. The moth shall eat them up. So this is a straightforward verse from Isaiah where the moth obviously stands for the enemies are going to be devoured. The devouring moth is like
this
the enemy.
Here it's, we're now looking at other places where moth is used.
So we got, right, the connection here is moth, moth. And as you're going to keep watching, the connection changes basically from verse to verse to
but
verse.
But if we look at the Hebrew, is the Hebrew the same? the word
as what?
As whatever they were translating.
No, because that's
here.
Greek.
Right, but if we, it, but they took the Hebrew is hedek, right?
Yes. So the Christians translated that as moth.
Okay, but in Isaiah, is the Hebrew in Isaiah hedek?
I do not know. And there, it doesn't have to be because there could be more than one word for moth.
Right, but as far as like for us in the Hebrew, we're look. It was Micah and Isaiah. To us, it matters what the Hebrew says.
It well, it doesn't. It doesn't because I'm not saying that these two verses are related. I'm saying that the concept of a moth appears in Isaiah.
Okay.
Which I'm playing off the moth that appears in the Septuagint.
So we're actually diverging from the Hebrew here because the
yes,
Septuagint
we're not doing a word for word thing.
Okay.
It's more of a concept
okay.
for concept
Got
thing.
It. Okay.
Okay. So now you have another example from Isaiah, not really far away. For the moth shall eat them up like a garment, and the worm shall eat them like wool. But my favor, God's favor, shall be forever, and my salvation unto all generations. So once again, it's the moth and the worm as insects that eat things up. They are devourers. They are enemies. Okay. Now, moth concept was not unknown in the ancient world. The Greeks also used the moth metaphor. So now we have Pindar, who is a, you know, one of those highfalutin Greeks. We have a quote from him about gold. Gold is the child of Zeus. Neither moth nor rust can consume it. Okay. What do we learn from this one? We learn, again, that moths eat things, that Greeks knew about moths eating things, and we also have an equation of moths with rust, right, which is new. Just as a moth consumes things, in effect, rust consumes things.
They both destroy.
This is where we're jumping into another term.
Yeah, they both destroy something, a garment.
They both destroy their object. And now we're going to jump into two different verses from the Christian Bible. Which is going to change the story again. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust ruin them, and where thieves break in and steal them. Rather, store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust ruin them, and where thieves neither break in nor steal them. For where your treasure is, there will be your heart also. Okay. Destruction of enemies has now been transferred as destruction of treasure. Right? That's what we start off with. You have treasures on earth. Moths can eat your treasure up, but so can thieves. Now, thieves and moths are kind of on the same plane. And now we're talking about not your earthly valuables like gold. We're talking about, well, we are actually still talking about that. That will change. But if you go away from treasures on earth, physical things, to treasures in heaven, there nothing can devour it. So what, you know, this is a very kind of modern thought.
It's not
right?
metaphorical anymore.
It's not a thing. Your value in life is not things, it's your good deeds. And why? And here is another turning, because it's going to heaven. Now we've also thrown in the soup, heaven. Okay.
Yeah, but also, because here they're talking less metaphorical about the moth and the rust destroying physical objects that you own, as opposed to the moth destroying the enemy.
Right, right. Yes, there's a definite shift now into material things, as you said. Okay, now we quote from Luke. Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to the poor. Okay, material things, you don't need them. Provide purses for yourselves that will not wear out, a treasure in heaven that will never fail. Same motif, treasures in heaven, not physical things. Where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. Again, thief, moth, same thing, devourers of material things. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also, which is a repeat, again, of the verse in Matthew. But this is now changed into this kind of Christian idea of treasures. So where are we? We stop here for the moment. So we've gone on this tangent of moths to thieves to good deeds to heavenly treasures. And heavenly treasures are about rewards in the afterlife. And Israel, and now we go all the way back to the original verse about Gehenna, Israel is the moth that's going to devour you, Gentiles, in the afterlife, in Gehenna. Does everyone get there? It's a long road around.
Well, who's saying that? Who's making that connection?
All the way back to Rabbi Joshua. That's the nature of when he says, the best of them is as a briar, means they grind the nations of the world into Gehenna.
So we're using all of these texts to understand Joshua's statement.
Yes. Right? Because again, that was my question to you, is how did we get there? That second response seems to be just completely out of left field.
Where is Joshua's name anywhere in
there? It's in paragraph 2 on the first page.
Okay.
Rabbi Joshua ben Hananiah.
Okay. So really, this is the argument being made by this scholar that you quoted in the beginning. It's this scholar that put all this together. Joshua was not aware of all this stuff. It's not like a traditional proof text kind of thing.
No, don't say that. Because that...
You think?
Hold that thought.
Okay.
Okay. Hold that thought.
Just define Gehenna.
Hell.
Hell. Yeah.
Oh. Okay. And how come they don't bring about destroying the worm? They're bringing up the moth, and.
Well, the moth and the worm are the same thing in the end.
Because the moth larva.
Right.
Is the worm.
Oh, all right. Good point.
Okay. So now let's go all the way back to Rabbi Joshua. So he's responding to the mean, to the heretic, as follows. First of all, the verse talks about a briar, not a moth. This is clear from the end of the verse and the intended meaning of the briar image. That is, the briar is a protective source from Israel. But even if you don't accept this reading, there is a third interpretation that turns the moth image on its head. The verse compares Israel's leaders to those who crush and destroy. Rabbi Joshua draws on another verse from Micah for the wordplay and situates the destruction of the nations in Gehenna. This undermines the Christian reading of the verse, which is that believers, their deeds will secure them a treasure in the next world that will be safe from moths. Okay, so why these stories? Why these three? Why these possibilities? No, I'm not saying the right way. Why? Here's the question for all of you now. Why did Rabbi Joshua respond to the heretic in the way he did?
I'm going to give you two answers.
I'm going to give you, let you think about the third. So the first is that this is a reality of the Persian Empire, that the rabbis walked around and Christians didn't like them and they challenged them with Bible verses, and the rabbis had to show their knowledge of the Torah, of the Bible, by responding with verses to them. Right? That's the reality.
Do you know when Joshua ben
Hananiah lived? I do not have the date off the top of my head.
Okay.
He's probably an Amora. So he lived from 200 to 600 somewhere.
Okay. All right. Because Matthew and Luke, I just looked them up, were written in the 70s or 80s.
Yeah, and they didn't become canonized till after 100.
Yeah, oh, wow.
So,
but the books existed. I was just curious about it.
Yeah, that's true. So the Gospels started coming out around 60s with the earliest.
It says Luke was written around 70 and Matthew in the 90s, 80s or 90s.
So again, it's like Michelle, keep that in mind because it's going to be relevant to the last piece.
So he would have known about the books.
Yes. Yes, that's very important.
First half century following the destruction of the temple.
So that would put him around Bar Kokhba time, like 100 CE, 130 CE.
So he's playing on the fact that the mean guy is going to interpret all the moth differently.
Yes. Yes. Yes, and that... So hold that again.
Okay.
I want to go back to my possibilities.
Okay.
Okay, so number one, reflection of reality of the time. Number two, this could... why this story in the first place? It could reflect the anxieties of the rabbis living in the time that they did, that they were going to be challenged about Judaism being a minority. I always like to think of modern analogies. I guess it's like when you're the only Jewish kid in your class and you kind of got to be armed because the kids are going to say, why don't you celebrate Christmas? And it's going to make you a little edgy because you have to respond to that. Okay, now comes the psychological thing. And this is really the contribution of this scholar to the answer. So can anyone think of what connects all these dots? Why the rabbi would answer, not the first answer, which I think we could all live with, you know, you got the Bible, you don't know your Bible, but the second answer of the Jews are going to crush you, you know, turn over your values and destroy you in the next life. So now you can ask your question, make your point.
Well, that he understood how the Christian or the mean or whatever we're calling
yes.
would interpret the moth, the headache, the moth,
right,
as devouring the treasures,
right.
But right, so the Christians are teaching in Matthew and Luke that your heavenly reward can't be destroyed by the moth, and he's saying we will destroy it because we're sending you to Gehenna where we will destroy your values,
right. So go back to Michelle because she's really got it by the tail. So imagine the Catholic priest walks into Borough Park and sees a Hasid and starts up an argument. You know, your Torah says this, but it really means something else. Would you expect the rabbi to say, well, priest, your theology says that this verse means Jesus is a lamb, but it really means the Jews are going to destroy you. Would you expect him to know that?
No, but that's what Joshua was doing here.
Right, but Joshua knows that. It's just what Michelle said. So what does it mean? It means the rabbis were living in a culture where they knew about Christianity. More than that, they knew about Christian theology. They were familiar, as is your piece, they were familiar with these books that are floating around. But they're obviously not running through the Talmud quoting them. So it has to mean, this is the big reveal, that they're living in a culture where they're aware of what's going on around them. They're thinking about it and responding to the challenges in their own heads or maybe among themselves. But they're not writing it down in the Talmud. Only as a response to the heretic. And in fact, maybe the whole story is made up just to show that fact. And that's a really new way of looking at these stories. Right? So I had my notes here. A, Christianity now does appear in the Talmud, which actually does all over the place, but that's another story. And remember, this is being written in Persia. Not in Israel. Two, the rabbis knew about Christianity. They were conversant with it. And number three, not only did they know, but they were able to engage with the ideas of Christianity, the literature of Christianity, and respond to Christians in a Jewish way. And that's that in a sense is a big thing. In fact, to tell a quick story, I listen to a lot of podcasts because I have a long commute, and there was one I just heard of. It's a rabbi who spent a year in India at a religious Indian institution. He's like the scholar in residence. Now, I grew up with very dear Indian friends, and I went to all their celebrations. They came to ours. We knew them very well. But I realized I know nothing about Hinduism. And this rabbi was explaining that Hinduism is very like Judaism. This shocked me. In fact, they had a board of rabbis from Israel go to India and spend months or whatever, and they declared that Hinduism is completely compatible with Judaism. It is not a monotheistic religion. They do not worship all those millions of idols they have in their homes and temples. I thought they did too. This is until a week ago. And it's comparable to this that, you know, how would I know that? Because I'd have to study their culture and live with them in order to make those connections. So I think that's an absolutely fascinating thing.
But the rabbis were living in a Christian society.
Well, in Persia, it was a mix. They were on the border between Rome and Persia. So they were probably more influenced by Persia than by Rome. But they did know these things.
No, just like those of us today, we have a certain handle on basic Christian culture.
Right.
Because we live in a Christian world.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And they...
So it doesn't
surprise
me that the Jewish scholars would know it because they were surrounded by it.
No, but it would surprise you if that were true in Borough Park, right? This is a community that seeks to isolate itself from the rest of Jewish society, not so much even outside society.
I'd actually like to think that the true scholars in Borough Park do know. Not the men on the street,
but out knowledge.
Correct. I'd like to believe that the scholars... But I said I'd like to believe.
Right, but the reality is probably not that.
Yeah, but during that time, weren't they trying to convert the Jews to Christianity, and the rabbis were trying to fight back? So, you know...
Christianity wasn't as set at this point. One-third...
Yeah, very much not.
It was very fluid. It was not a religion as we recognize it today.
It had just finished being a sect of Judaism.
And it still was in Israel.
Right. Yeah. This is
kind of, we're at the point where they've broken off.
Not quite. We're at the beginning of that period. Because it's really after the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135.
Bar Kokhba is when they split.
I mean, Fran, the difference would be, this would be like sitting next to someone in shul, and you two say the same prayers, know the same things, except he or she thinks, you know, Bernie Sanders is the Messiah. I mean, literally, not politically. Right? You're not drumming them out of shul. You're not going to stand up and say, you get out of here. That's what it was like in those days.
Well, they were so closely identified in the beginning. And we're still in the beginning.
Right.
We're not in the beginning.
We're at the end.
Getting to the
we're
middle,
the
I would say.
Yeah, but I think... Yeah.
And remember from last time, you know, by 135, the Jews had been expelled from Judea, so there were no Jews living in Jerusalem. They'd all moved to the Galilee, and a lot of those rabbis had moved to Babylonia, and their Christianity would not become the official religion of Rome until 335. So it's still 200 years away. Okay, so I thought it'd be interesting... That was the main issue. But now that you have the scholarly tools, I thought it would be interesting to present another two of these stories so you could take a look at them. So now if you go to page... Where are we? Two? Three?
Page two. We're off of
eight. Oh. Oh, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. I never finished with all my sources on page two because I thought I did run into the rest of the stories.
You're using the Book of Tobit, so you can't skip that.
These were more of the ideas floating around about treasures in heaven and so on. Yes, so I had a Talmudic reference to your values on earth. Then there's Tobit, which, as Stu points out, is in the Apocrypha is outside of the Bible, but it was a Jewish book. And then Philo, who was a Jewish scholar who lived in Alexandria at the time of Jesus, who was Greek, and he again talks about storehouses and so on. So, I'm sorry, read those for yourselves. I'll move on to the top of page 3. So this is Brachot, the first tractate of the Talmud, and now you can start to see. A certain min said to Bruria. Bruria is the most famous female scholar in the Talmud. She's the wife of Rabbi Meir, who's a great scholar. And
you can't tell
Orthodox institutions typically name their yeshivas for women after Bruria because of her fame. So the heretic comes up to her with another verse from the Tanakh, which in this case is Isaiah. Sing, O barren, you that did not bear. And he asks the question,
does it para?
Because she did not bear, is she to sing? In other words, this woman is unable to have a child. Why would she be singing about that? She'd be crying over that. Bruria replies to him, you fool! Look at the end of the verse, same words. Mm-hmm. Where it is written, for the children of the desolate shall be more than the children of the married wife, says the Lord. So, the end of the verse says that the children of the desolate will be better than that of the married wife. And now again, in the same kind of set of tools, she goes on to answer too. What is the meaning of a barren woman that did not bear? A barren that did not bear. Yes, no woman there. Sing, O community of Israel, who resemble a barren woman, for not having born children like you, the heretic, for Gehenna. Right? It's almost an exact same thing where A, she shows him the real meaning of the verse of the Bible, which he doesn't know, and B, she turns it around into the Jews rule, you're going to hell. So that's another example. And finally, this is a longer example about a mean, which is interesting because now it's a nuanced view. It's not, you'll see in a moment. So once again, a certain mean, and when it says a certain, that's just Talmud speech for like Joe Schmo.
This guy.
Once said to Rabbi. Rabbi is Rabbi Judah Hanasi, the one who compiled the Mishnah in 200 CE. He's very beloved, so he's called Rebbe without a name. And again, there's another verse from Amos, which I put below. He who formed the mountains did not create the wind, and he who created the wind did not form the mountains. So, obviously, what's the theological problem here? It's saying God did one but not two, or God did two but not one, but God didn't do both. Ha ha, in the words of Edward G. Robinson in the Ten Commandments, where's your God now? That's not what he says, but it's close. He replied, you fool, turn to the end of the verse. The Lord of hosts is his name. In other words, so it only responds with one God at the end of that verse. This so perturbed the heretic, he said, there's a lot of he's in this one. Give me 3 days' time and I will bring back an answer to you. So Rebbe was very pious because this was an important debate. He spent those 3 days fasting, and he was about to eat. He was told there is a min waiting at the door. Now, it's not the same guy. It's a different min.
How do we know that?
Different heretic, because you'll see. Rebbe exclaimed, yay, they put poison into my food, meaning the min is back. He's got an answer for me. That's what he thinks. But this min says, my master, I bring you good tidings. Your opponent, that's how we know, could find no answer, so he threw himself down from the roof and died. Okay, it was a very important debate. So Rebbe is very relieved. He says to the min number two, would you dine with me? He replied, yes. After they had eaten and drunk, he said to him, and by the way, notice that he is dining with a heretic. You know, back to my analogy, would a guy from Borough Park sit down and have a meal with a priest?
And
probably
have wine?
In his house. Probably no not. And wine,
well,
yes.
It's rabbi's wine.
After they had eaten drunk, he said to him...
Not in the presence of
him. Yeah, but he was afraid he would libate, but he wasn't looking.
Well, if he doesn't... Yeah, well, if he never turns his eyes away, it's okay.
So, Rebbe says to the heretic, will you drink the cup of wine over which the benedictions of the grace, now that Birkat HaMazon, had been said, or would you rather have 40 gold coins? And the min says, I would rather drink the cup of wine.
What?
Thereupon, the voice of God comes out of the cloud and says, the cup of wine over is worth 40 gold coins. Coda. Rabbi Isaac said, the family of that min is still to be found among the notables of Rome, and it is the Bar Luanius family. So, what do we get about this story?
The original righteous Gentile.
Yes, the tone is very different here. We have a good min and a bad min. And the good min gets rewarded. And this is a question mark. Maybe the point of the story is that this took place later in time. It certainly, it's, I guess, 100 years after Rabbi Joshua. And maybe there was more social integration in those days.
Would this be a conversion?
No.
Because
it even tells you his family stayed heretics.
The family of that min.
Yeah.
So they're just referring to him as the min. They're not.
But it's min number two, the good min.
Right. Yeah, min number two. He's still to be found amongst the notables of Rome. And his name, I don't know. Because he's saying that he would rather drink the wine that's been blessed.
Right.
Which would be part of a...
That's a stretch.
I don't know. Maybe it is.
Right, drinking wine is not part of conversion. So, I don't think so.
But you'd rather be in the company of someone religious and do
something exactly.
Soulful rather than have the material
objects. That's what I'm saying. In other words, he's...
Yes.
I don't know. Okay.
So, being religious and, you know, what your religion is, just being amongst someone who's spiritual, mm-hmm. is greater than any material.
I agree with you, Fran. I think that's what it means.
Oh, wow. And I know nothing about it.
And finally, I just threw in a little coda here from the Talmud. When the soul of Rabbi Joshua ben Chananya was about to go to its rest, the rabbi said to him, what will become of us at the hands of the heretics? In other words, we've lost our spokesman.
He's not here to battle them down anymore.
Yes. So that is the Baruch Tehiyah.